station in New York. See the explosive story of Men in War when Cinema 9 presents David Bryan, John Agar, and Frank Lovejoy in Breakthrough at Sunday night at 7:30 on WOR TV Channel 9.
Sometimes I'm happy, Rasputin, sometimes I'm sad. Oh, sometimes I'm whoopee, sometimes I'm glad. La cha da cha 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 da cha cha. Oh, we're on the air. Oh, excuse me, gang. Didn't know that this thing was live. I'm sneaking in there a little bit. Oh, hello, crowd. Oh, it's old Smiley here. Hi, George. And, I better give a disclaimer here very quickly before we get too deeply involved, before you get sucked in again. And as you probably are aware, you've been sucked in many times in your life. George, that's true. You're not alone, I'll tell you that. How do you think I wound up working here? Doing this? That's another story, a sordid, rotten story we don't even want to go into. But however, we'd better warn you that this could very well be a scary-type show, and I know that a lot of people today are a little worried about scary-type things, and, well, I just thought I'd warn you. Maybe you'd better go now before it's too late. Cha-cha, sometimes I'm happy. Oh, what an enigmatic dish rag this guy is. Oh, yes, indeed, the time has come once more. Every spring, as we go slowly sneaking into summer, those dark, hidden things that are way inside of the soul of man begin to stir. They begin to lick their chops. And everywhere man looks, he sees skulking, hulking figures in the bushes. Yeah. This is the time of year, you know, that T.S. Eliot said, he said, April is the, what is it, saddest month? Grueliest month? Don't go, whoa, whoa, whoa. That doesn't quite come through the glass, honey. He did not say April is the grooviest month. I don't believe that's what he said. April is the scariest month? No, that is not a, it's on the tip of my tongue. I mean, a lot of stuff on the tip of my tongue lately. That's it. Hold it up. That's right. April is the cruelest month. But why? Why not say September? Why not take a nothing month like February? This is a nothing month. Why April? Well, there's a reason for it. That when April arrives and May begins to slowly emerge over the horizon, when June begins to rear its lovely head, man begins to fight those demons down inside of himself. Oh, he feels the sap moving through his veins. He feels ancient urges that no longer really are part of his daily life. No wonder the druids had their big time in the spring. You know, the druids, they have these fertility rites, and people dance around maypoles, and they throw halos into the air made of spring flowers, and they wear laurel leaves and the whole business. Oh, it's beginning to show. And already the first report has come in. And it's come from, believe it or not, such a commonplace state as the state of New Jersey. Now, you would think it would come out of the dismal swamp, wouldn't you? Of Virginia. Or you'd think it would come out of some exotic place like California. Oh, no. Would you please bring me my scary music before you do anything else, Don? Then you can get up and scratch. Here it comes. Whoa. Special report from the Asbury Park, New Jersey Press. Datelined April 1966. By George Brown, Asbury Park Press staff writer. The first clue. The first omen in the wind that the nutty season has begun. Is the legendary Jersey Devil once again prowling the Pine Barrens of South Jersey? Oh, oh. The legendary Jersey Devil, just quietly, that's it, is once again prowling the Pine Barrens of South Jersey. State police at Tuckerton don't believe in demons, but concede they don't know what is causing the mysterious disappearance of animals and birds from a pond at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Stephen Silcotch of Hamilton Road. Mr. Silcotch says the toll since April the 8th stands at 31 ducks, 4 cats, 3 geese, 2 dogs, and an unknown amount of duck and goose eggs. Well, let me tell you, whatever it is, it's a pretty large animal, Trooper Alfred Potter said yesterday. Anything that's going to carry 4 cats and 2 dogs away and eat 31 ducks in 1 week has to be pretty large. He said he saw footprints left by the midnight marauder that are, quote, bigger than a man's hand. Mrs. Silcotch said yesterday her husband had heard the thing prowling about the yard, but hasn't ventured out to investigate. She said it sounded like a pretty heavy animal. And it snuffled as it went. State police have increased their patrols in the area, but they say they have not seen devil, demon, or other forms of prowler. The Sockages say that the unidentified visitor usually strikes between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m. Last year, Mrs. Silcotch said the family lost 30 ducks and numerous duck and goose eggs before it finally stopped it. That stopped the raids. They stopped the raids by raising noises in their yard at certain specified hours. She said she has not seen anything in the neighborhood like bears. The family maintains the duck pond in the back for pleasure. But this year, the thing, it, eats all the duck eggs up before we can even get to them. The Jersey Devil, whose last reported appearance, quote, was in 1936, is described as cloven-hoofed, long-tailed, and white, with the head of a collie dog, the face of a horse, the wings of a bat, and the disposition of a monster. In that year, farmers armed with shotguns scoured the swamps near Woodstown searching for the devil. The search began after a woman and several children reported being frightened by the demon on several separate occasions. He has never been known to harm anyone on his nocturnal prowlings. Yet. And in 1936, a prediction was made by several prominent seers in the area that the devil would return in exactly 20 years. And so the Jersey Devil is on the prowl again, hanging around the pizza joints, snuffing around the back of the drive-ins, lurking beside the Jersey Turnpike, hiding in the bushes beside the Howard Johnson. Its cloven hoofs, its collie-like face, and its monster attitudes. Yeah. Cut it there, Don. That's it. That's enough. Hello, test. Very good. Very good. Wow. You know, I it's funny about this thing that we have inside of us. That no matter how scientific, no matter how objective man is, no matter how, I suppose you can say civilized he is, there are dark forms lurking in his mind. And he always sees things almost the same way, you know. When people have fantasies, when people have, for example, delirium tremens, they often see cloved, hoofed, horned creatures. Have you ever heard of guys talking about that, Don? About guys seeing bats, snakes, and they all, you know, well, then I don't know where you've been living. that the problem, why do we see those things? Why is it when a guy has delirium tremens, he doesn't see doorknobs? Why is it he doesn't see pandas? Why is it he doesn't see teddy bears? He sees rats. He sees snakes. He sees bats. He sees the things that the soul of man has always been afraid of, no matter what. Yeah. I wonder if a scientist, some guy, say, who works for a big computer company, and finally takes the drink, and he starts knocking the stuff down, and after about 15 years, and all of a sudden he pops his lid, blows his skull, and he's lying there on the sack, you know, he's twisting and turning. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden he starts seeing these fantastic images. No, no, not the whoopee music. Give me the sneaky music. He starts seeing these fantastic images. He wakes up in cold sweat. He stares at the wall. Does he see the console of a phantom IBM computer on the rampage emerging from the wallpaper? Coming after him. No. What does he see? Snakes. That's right. What does he see? Bats. Guys that have never seen a live bat in their life all of a sudden see bats when they go off. Really, when they start going off in the deep end. They do. Batfly. Did you ever see that movie on late television, The Lost Weekend? You remember the scene where Ray Milland is sitting there, and he's all of a sudden he sees coming out of the wall this rat, fantastic rat coming out of the wall. He jumps up, and it's and he sees this bat crawling on the wall. Oh wow, what a scene! That's a real horror picture. When I think of a horror picture, I do not think of a monster that's coming out of the fourth galaxy beyond the seventh ring of Alpha Centaurus. You know, some monster that you can see is made out of plastic. Some giant monster that suddenly shows up and it's got hair all over it and it runs through the streets and goes, You know what my idea of a fantastic monster movie would be? Seriously. That scene was one of the most horrible scenes I've ever seen in the movies. It scared me far more than any of these plastic paper dinosaurs that constantly keep coming out of the upper. Hey, I wonder what monster, what guys who wrote horror movies wrote about before the atom bomb. Have you noticed every monster today is as the cause of, he comes around because of mutation? Yeah, there must have been 14 million movies written using that fantastic cliche. And then there's always one scientist who says to the other one, "Well, Charles, when man learns that he cannot tamper with the innermost secrets of nature, man will be assured a place among the Earth's creatures." And then another one of the great cliches constantly is to see in the movie. You see this in the so-called avant-garde movie makers. You know, everybody's got his own cliches. I guess a cliche is not a cliche until it's been designated a cliche. But if I see one movie, once again, that ends with an explosion of an atom bomb, I think I'll throw up. You know? That's the greatest cliche in our time. It's a fantastic cliche. It's the way to end it. Whenever you don't know how to end it, you go... And then you have on the subtitle say, "And so came the end." Everybody says, "Gee, that must have been a fantastically profound movie." Holy smokes. Well, if you've got a bad play to write, fella, I'm going to give you another word of advice. If you've got a rotten play to write out there, don't make the guy a plumber. You know, don't make the guy an insurance salesman. Make him a nuclear scientist. And automatically people say, "Gee, that's got deep inner meaning." Either that or make him a cardinal. Yeah, you can do that. That's pretty good. You know, it's not very popular anymore to write about kings. In the early days, when a guy was writing a bad play, he always had a king involved. You know, or a countess. Something like that. But that's all out, you know. That's all passé. So today, write about, don't mess around. The plumbers, nothing happens to plumbers. They don't live any dramatic lives. And even if what your character is doing is banal, like sitting on a deck chair somewhere in a third-rate resort having an argument with his wife, it has no meaning, really, unless he's an atomic scientist. Then you could have read a deeper inner meaning in that. He is man alienated from the great source of the wellspring of the vital springs of power and energy that create man in the first place, in the hoc agricola conch in hospital. Speaking of, that reminds me, this is WORAM and FM in New York, and we have a couple of local commercials here.
This is your fire preventing friend Smokey Bear with a special word for city folks. I'm afraid that most people who live in the city never give too much thought to forest fires. Of course, it may be hard for you to understand how you're affected by some fire far away in the big woods. But forest fires can affect the price you pay for your home, your furniture, even your daily newspaper. And if you're like most folks, you like to visit our forests, parks, and recreation areas now and then. When you do, try to remember this. No matter how well-meaning you are, your very presence in the forest is a threat to its life. All it takes is one careless match, or a smoke that isn't crushed dead out, or a campfire that isn't drowned, and a forest that's thousands of years old could die in one afternoon. This is Smokey Bear asking for your help, folks. Please, only you can prevent forest fires.
Let's see. How about Honda? Fleischmann Honda. It says Honda. Fleischmann Honda, and I'm going to repeat it. It's Fleischmann Honda. If you're planning to buy a Honda, and a lot of you are, I'm getting all kinds of letters from people asking questions about motorcycles in general and the Honda in particular. By all means, contact Fleischmann. Fleischmann is the biggest dealer in the East and one of the biggest in the world. He has four setups out on the island, and they are totally equipped that no matter what Honda Fleischmann dealer that you buy from. In other words, no matter what Fleischmann store that you buy your Honda, they're repaired at any of the four without any problems. They have great service departments, and even if you're driving a Honda that you got somewhere else years ago, I'd suggest you find out about Fleischmann. They're kind of like the Yankees of the Honda dealership. And let's see, they have four locations. Two of them are on Sunrise Highway. You in that area, West Islip, one in Bayshore. They have one in Long Beach on Long Beach Boulevard, and then they have one on Queens Boulevard in Woodside, just 1 mile west of the New Macy's. You can't miss it. And when you go to that one, ask for Al. He's the guy that I always yell with. Nargis, he's the big guy there. Now, this is Fleischmann Honda, and I'm just making the point here that these people not only sell motorcycles, they teach you to ride them, which you'll find is quite important. you know, you don't just get up on the saddle and turn it on. It doesn't work like that. They also get the insurance for you. They make sure that you're all insured. They make sure, too, that you have license plates. You just go to Fleischmann, they'll take care of the whole scene. And they have a tremendous collection of them out there. Fleischmann Honda. Let's see, now we got Rover. We'll do Rover. And before we do Rover, let's do Wilmoth. Where if you've been having trouble... By the way, one thing about Wilmoth, I must make a quick note here. I don't think I made this very clear lately. That you can't go into Wilmoth and just buy a suit. There is no picking them off the gas pipe racks at Wilmoth. This is a place where they're custom-made. This is a place where you come in. They have about 1,500 fabrics that you choose from. They measure you, and they will make a suit to your measure. And you have to wait a couple of weeks for them to finish it up. But, boy, when you get it, this is a suit that's made to fit you. They do not pick it off the gas pipe racks in any sense of the word. This is not a place where they alter a suit for you. They build it for you, and that's a big difference. This is Wilmoth, and you can hit a custom-made suit there for as little as $69.95. And the reason they can do this is because they have a tremendous volume. They have stores all over the country doing this. It's not just one little tailoring shop that puts these things together. This is Wilmoth, and they have about 1,500 fabrics, thousands of styles. They make shirts and everything. And the only finished suits in a Wilmoth store is a suit that's waiting to be picked up. That some customer has left there. Now, let's see. Here's one right here. In Manhattan, 122 Nassau Street. In Brooklyn, at 2138 86th Street. Okay? Right. And we have Rover here. And it's beginning to be a little redundant. I'm a little embarrassed about talking about Rover. And I know this is the time of year when a lot of guys are getting the itch about going out and getting cars. And if you want a genuinely new experience in driving, I'm serious about this. It's not just advertising glop. If you want to drive a car that engineers all over the world are today studying because it's one of the most advanced automobiles that is on the road today, I would suggest that you contact your nearest Rover dealer. Just go over there and take a look at this thing and drive it, and you'll find out why Car and Driver, for example, says that this car is at least 5 years ahead of anything that is on the road today. And it really is. In every sense, it's a fast machine. Can you imagine a car that will give you over... Well, it'll easily cruise anywhere up to 100 miles an hour. This is the TC2000. And give you gas mileage in excess of 25 up to 30, 32 miles to the gallon. That's a... Yeah, beautifully designed machine. And it has fantastic braking power. It's sprung like nothing you've ever ridden before. It's Rover. And if you want pictures of the Rover, we'll send them to you. Just send your name and address to Rover here at WOR. Now, let's get back to the monster world. You know, I've wondered about this. I must give you another word of warning. I always have to do this. This is a deepie, and I hope it's not boring you. But I've often wondered, when I sit out there and watch movies, monster movies, you know, horror movies, as a man, I'm talking about as part of mankind, just as part of the human race, what is there in us that makes us enjoy the phenomena of fright? Now, if I were to use the word fright to you and just say fright, now that sounds like a bad word. It sounds like one of those things you don't want. You don't want to be frightened. And yet, we continually and consistently seek the very thing which frightens us. Now, I don't know of any other animal that does this. I doubt very much whether, let us say, if bears are frightened of human beings, Don. Have you thought about this? Do you think that bears go and seek out human beings so they can be frightened because they enjoy being frightened? It's just one of those things I've wondered about. Well, it may be someone else, but I'm not so sure. Yeah, that's right. Don just held up a little note there. Don Williamson, our engineer, and he says it's because we're watching someone else being frightened. But not necessarily, because many people will go to a movie that literally frightens them. They'll get scared out of their skull. They'll be sit there in the third reel and they're just out of their mind. You know, they're scared. They're hanging out of the seats. And they'll go home and they'll say, that's the greatest movie I ever saw. Holy smokes. And they'll advise everybody to go see it. Now, let's go further than that. We seek this fright in many ways. Have you ever considered the concept of an amusement park? That amusement parks are largely based on fright. And so a man who gets on the roller coaster, the thing goes up 400 feet in the air, and it suddenly tilts over and goes plunging down, straight down. It's a frightful experience, really. It's a controlled fall. Then the thing goes whistling through a tunnel and makes a fantastic sharp curve, and you have the sense that any minute now the thing is going to fly off the track, and you're going to go 400 feet down into the cavern. Now, sometimes in the summertime, when you go to an amusement park, you'll see people waiting in long lines to go on these things. Now, what is the lure of that? I don't know of any other animal that does this. I don't know of any animal, let's say, like the mountain goat, who says, watch this. And he leaps down a cliff just to see whether or not he's going to get killed or not. We do it. Let's take the phenomena of skydiving. The phenomenon of skydiving, where people will go up and they will jump out of an airplane because it's a frightful feeling, really. Now, you can say it's an exhilarating feeling, but I'm going to tell you this, that the exhilaration comes from the fright. That a person jumps out, and after all, let's face it, he is falling. He is 3,000 feet in the air, and he is hurtling down through space. There is a question, no matter how safe, quote, you call it, whether that parachute will open. It is not a 100% operation, as any paratrooper will tell you. It is not. Now, I say to you that if it were a 100% operation, people wouldn't go on it. They wouldn't care that much for it. Now, the fright, I'm wondering about this. I'm just contemplating it, and I don't think anyone has seriously ever been able to explain it. It's one of the inexplicable things that make us what we are. And so, everywhere you look, movies are playing. The more and more movies play that, in a sense, are frightening. Now, I also have a feeling, too, that this is closely connected with the current LSD craze. Yes, it is. That I've known many people who have been on LSD, and they see, in many ways, often, they see many of the same hallucinations that a man who is under delirium tremens has. Oh, yes. That a man who is having delirium will quite often see fantastic flowers growing in the room, or he'll see great waves of heat coming out of the wall. All of a sudden, he screams, he flips. Well, I think that it depends on your psyche. Some people would consider that a pleasurable experience, and others would be frightened out of their skull. That's one of the reasons why people have varying reactions to LSD. People also have varying reactions to a horror movie. One man's kick, believe me, is another man's fright. And you saw this in Nazi Germany. Oh, sure. Can you imagine one of the famous... I wonder how... some things are so horrible that mankind will do that people don't even do... You know, they don't write about it or say anything about it. Can you imagine a lady with her house? Just a woman, you know. She's got a house, and she's got a kind of a middle-class house. And she has her lampshades made out of human skin. And she particularly enjoys lampshades that have exotic tattoos on them. I'm not inventing this. You know who that woman was. Now, if you can put her down, you can say, well, she was a sick woman. Sure, she was a sick, but remember this, she was a sick human being. which puts it into a little different context. That I have never known of a bear, for example, collecting the skins of other bears and tacking them around the walls of the cave merely because there's a certain amount of pleasure out of that. I happen to have spent a little time down in headhunter country, and when you see that many tribes use human heads as decor. In fact, I remember seeing a little kid in the headhunter country that had a dried human foot that was hanging around his neck as part of his necklace. I just thought you ought to know these things. So I'm just asking, what manner of being are we? What manner of creature are we? Now, you can't separate, say, well, those are awful people, and I wouldn't do that. And yet the same kind of person who would never collect that sort of thing will get a fantastic kick out of watching a late horror movie. The fright, this heady feeling of danger is all around. And I've just wondered about these things, just in casual passing. What there is in us that makes us enjoy. And I think that if we were to discover that, what our hunger is for fright, we would discover a great deal about mankind and also understand why we continually have wars. Because this is part of the ultimate fright. We seek this thing out. I think we seek wars out almost the way the individual. See, I think man in mass has a mass body. This is a theory that's been given out many times, that we are only partially individual. That we really are parts, tiny parts, each one of us are tiny parts of a giant body that really is in a way an extension of and a deviation from the composite of its parts. And so man as a body, a great body, man seeks thrills as a body that individual man does not seek. And so individual man is constantly confused by the fact that mankind always has wars. Because as an individual, he doesn't seek war. As a body, he does. Now, how about that one? This theory has been put forth. You don't hear this very often, do you? This theory, where guys keep thinking that man has wars because man is insane, or it's because a few insane people want a war, or because a few nutty political guys want a war, or some big company wants to sell flexible flyers, so they have a war. That's a very easy cop-out. And the illusion always is, the illusion always is that if we can get rid of this group, or we can get rid of that group, or we can get this kind of scene going in this mental hospital, that eventually we will beat the problem of war. Will you? That this giant body here seeks scenes, seeks a bodily or a corporeal kick that the individual doesn't go after. Now let's take on the other hand, is there an individual anywhere that does not seek thrills? I mean, even the most erudite, intellectual peace lover, he seeks his thrills. So on one hand, you find a guy in his private life, he will be shooting heroin, which is extremely dangerous. LSD, we know, is dangerous. Every pharmacologist in the business has been saying that. Not necessarily every psychiatrist, but every pharmacologist has been saying it. And certainly a lot of other people, too. So we individually, people, here's the kind of nuttiness. The guy will individually go out and do something like that. He will seek thrills and danger in heroin. And at the same time, he claims that he's against war. He can't understand why mankind goes for war. And I say they're part of the same thing. Now, that doesn't mean that they're operative all the time at the same time. And so there's always that battle. It's always been, you know, that constant struggle against the individual feeling, where a man walks around and he's himself, and he's here, and he's just a person. That constant struggle against that side of man and the side of man that could be called society or unit or mass man, unit versus mass man, unit meaning individual. And so if you think that struggle is over, it'll never be over. Because I think that quite often the thing that mass man wants to do, is very often diametrically opposed to what unit man wants to do. And yet he's pulled inexorably in both directions always, regardless of his will, that he is pulled in those directions. And so here you take one man in this day of anti-intellectualism, one man will find his vicarious thrills by shooting heroin into himself, and he will live in fantasies that way, and another man will have a book in his hand all the time, living fantasies. And so they're both fantasies, though. They're both vicarious living. And so a man who shoots heroin into his veins, and that removes him from the world around him and puts him into a state of hallucination, often a state of dreamy exhilaration, he will find, he's finding escape, really, in that form. All right, what's the difference between that than, say, an intellectual, a man who would never take dope or drug, sitting in a movie, having a vicarious love affair with Jean Moreau? And he will also have a drowsy state of unreality. Have you ever noticed that when you come out of a theater, that quite often it takes you a good 15 or 20 minutes to adjust yourself to the reality? You feel out of it for a while. You sort of have to shake your head, and you feel, gee, you know, and the light hits you and strikes you hard. Well, this is an extension, really. Let's put it this way. It's not really an extension. It's a very minor form of the same thing that happens to a drug addict when he comes out of his haze, and he finds himself in reality. The light hurts his eyes. He walks around and everything looks kind of harsh, and noises are very loud, and people seem to bump into him, and it's an unpleasant, rough, harsh feeling. Well, we all feel that when we come out of a movie for a few moments. We feel that. It is a pleasant sensation to let go. Now, people let go in their own way. Some let go by sliding off into drugs. Others let go by continually sliding off into somebody else's imagined life, like, say, James Bond. They're letting go of themselves, and it's a pleasant feeling. And it's some, though, however, are unfortunately not capable of letting go intellectually. Some people can't get involved in reading. Some people can't get involved in... Their mind is not capable of dealing with abstractions. For one reason or another, it doesn't mean that they're not intelligent, but they have to do it chemically. This is an interesting problem. and by the way, they're both habit forming in their own nutty way. Some people cannot stand life unless they've got a book in their hand. This is a habit. It's a kind of hang up. Some people can't stand being in the house without turning on the television and watching something. It's a habit. They get itchy and jumpy. They walk around in little circles. And, they show all the signs of the same kind of problem that say, they're beginning to make an interesting differentiation that has not yet been brought too broadly to the public between drug addiction and drug dependency. These are two different things, and in many ways, the drug dependency can be far subtler and far more dangerous than the addiction. One is merely a physical condition, and physical conditions quite often can be cured. A physical condition is where a man takes a certain kind of drug, let's say heroin, and his body physically and chemically begins to demand this substance to operate and to function normally. It's a physical dependency, or rather a physical, not even dependency, it's a physical necessity. that quite often a body will not even operate without this stuff. This is a fact. And it can be cured, though. It's not easy, but it can be cured since it is a chemical problem, and there's a lot of experimentation going into this. However, the new kind of addiction, you know, many people say marijuana is not addictive. That's true, but it causes a dependency, which can be even sneakier. Many a man today goes home and he gets high on pot night after night after night, and he can't split it. He can't leave it alone. And if you were to say to him, well, can you stop? He says, yeah, I can stop it. But he says, I choose not to. That's quite true. He's dependent on it now. And it helps him. Drift off into that dreamy state of unreality. It helps him escape the conditions under which he lives. Now, unfortunately, a dependency like that quite often leads to a desire for more, let's put it this way, stronger meat. Stronger meat. And who knows which way it'll go. Just like a movie addict, his addiction to movies demands stronger and stronger movies. And if you've noticed that the addiction is such today that we are piling one fantastic thrill in the movie upon the other, until eventually the total absurdity is reached, say, in something like Thunderball. Well, there's no plot at all, just a lot of series of blowing up, stabbings, killings, rapes, you name it, you know, just one after the other goes on and on and on and on. In short, the addict has demanded much stronger meat, and he will demand even stronger than that. Aldous Huxley talked about this, and he dealt with his feelies. He says that eventually we will have such strong meat. I don't know, and I'm not trying, I'm just sitting here ruminating, and I'm not doing it as an expert. I'm doing it as a human being who is also a human being and is just walking around. It's something that we can't really answer because we're close to it. Close to it. We're it. You can be no closer than to be it itself. I suppose if the squirrels were somehow to develop scientific observational techniques, they could find out what's wrong with us or what we are. Now, I'm not even using the word wrong. By the way, have you noticed, never once in any of this discussion have I given a moral slant to this. Because I think it is us that, it's not good or bad. Is gravity moral? Is gravity evil? Is up good and down bad? Is light in the sky good and darkness bad? No, we say it's bad, so that makes it bad. Does a bat think darkness is bad? It thinks light is bad. Does a fish think water is bad? It thinks air is bad. And so it's a fact of nature. We're talking about reality here. And I think we're a real creature. And one of the real things that we have a hunger for, and no one's explained it yet, is fright, danger, and hence drugs, hence James Bond, hence war, and hence who knows what. Ultimately, we're an interesting creature, but then again, I don't think there is any creature that isn't. We're probably more interesting to us because we're us, and I'm sure that bears are more interested in bears than they are in the, let's say, third grade reading pupils. So, you know, it all depends where you're sitting. It certainly does. One thing, keep your knees loose at tonight's horror mystery. You're watching yourself, you know, when you see that monster.